All right, welcome everyone to another deep dive here on the Lexapled podcast. Today we're going to be looking at a Supreme Court case that you might not have heard of, but it touches on some really important ideas.
Yeah, this one's a little under the radar, but it's fascinating.
So we're going to be talking about Lease v. Flint.
A 1979 decision that still has some real implications today.
Absolutely. And for this deep dive, we've got a really interesting mix of materials to work with.
We do. It's like we're going behind the scenes a bit. We've got some guidance that was specifically written to help us structure this very conversation.
Very meta.
Right. And we've also got this super in-depth analysis that really breaks down the legal arguments at the heart of the case.
Yeah, that perplexity analysis was really something.
It really was. And of course, we've got the standard legal brief for the case itself, all the essential facts, the questions the court was grappling with, and of course, what they ultimately decided.
Okay, so our mission today is to pull out the key insights from all of this. Why does this case, which on the surface seems to be about a pretty specific legal fight about out-of-state lawyers in Ohio, why does it still matter?
That's the question, isn't it?
What does it tell us about the balance of power between a state and the legal profession? Like, how much control does the state really have over who gets to practice law within its borders?
Lots to unpack here. So to kick things off, we need to start with this concept of pro hac vice. What is that all about?
Okay, so pro hac vice, it's Latin. It means for this particular occasion.
Makes sense.
Basically, it's the mechanism that allows a lawyer who's licensed in one state to temporarily practice in another state for a specific case.
Okay, so like if you've got a client in California, but their case is in New York, you might need to get pro hac vice admission to represent them in New York. Exactly. It can be a way to bring in specialized expertise or just to make sure a client can be represented by a lawyer they trust, even if that lawyer isn't licensed in that particular state. And here's the thing, back when this Lice v. Flint case happened, Ohio didn't have any formal written rules about pro hac vice admissions.
Oh, wow.
It was all very informal.
So you can already see how that can create some problems.
Right. Huge potential for things to go off the rails.
And this lack of clear rules really gets at the core tension in this whole case. A state's power to say who can and can't practice law there versus the rights that lawyers might have.
A classic legal showdown.
To set the scene, this whole thing started with Larry Flint.
Publisher of Hustler magazine.
Right, and he was facing obscenity charges in Ohio.
This was under Ohio Revised Code Section 2907.31, which was all about distributing material that was harmful to minors.
And Flint, he wanted the best legal representation he could get.
Naturally.
So he hires these two attorneys from New York, Harold Farringer and Paul Cambria.
These guys were heavy hitters. They had tons of experience with First Amendment cases and obscenity laws.
So you would think this would be a pretty routine thing. Flint's Ohio lawyer files an entry of appearance, listing Farringer and Cambria as part of the defense team.
Standard procedure, you'd think.
But here's where things get interesting. The form didn't specifically ask for pro hac vice admission for Farringer and Cambria.
Maybe they thought it was implied.
Maybe. But Judge Morrissey, who was presiding over the case, he just flat out denies Farringer and Cambria the ability to represent Flint.
No hearing, no explanation at that point.
And this is what sets off this whole chain reaction of legal challenges.
Yeah, Farringer and Cambria were not giving up easily.
They file what's called a mandamus action with the Ohio Supreme Court.
Basically asking a higher court to force a lower court to do something specific that they're legally obligated to do. In this case, to admit them to practice in Ohio for this case.
At the same time, they file an affidavit alleging bias against Judge Morrissey, implying that he wasn't impartial in this whole thing.
So they're fighting on two fronts.
Now, this is where it gets kind of messy. The Ohio Supreme Court, they dismissed the mandamus action.
Meaning they weren't going to force Judge Morrissey to admit the out-of-state lawyers.
But, and this is a big, but they do remove Judge Morrissey from the case because of those bias allegations.
Oh, wow.
So it's a partial win. They get the judge removed, but their main goal of actually being able to represent their client is still blocked.
Makes you wonder if that was their plan all along.
And it gets even more complicated. A new judge is assigned to the case, and this judge also refuses to let Farringer and Cambria practice in Ohio.
Really?
Yeah, and their reasoning was based on the Ohio Supreme Court's previous dismissal of the mandamus action. It's a total catch-22.
So no matter what they do, they're stuck.
Exactly. And this brings us to the really big question that eventually lands this case in the lap of the U.S. Supreme Court.
The ultimate legal authority.
Were Farringer and Cambria entitled to a hearing under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment before being denied admission to practice in Ohio.
A fundamental question of fairness, really.
I'd say, so let's get into the nitty-gritty here. What exactly was the legal issue that the Supreme Court was asked to decide?
All right, so the central question was whether an out-of-state attorney's interest in appearing pro hac vice in an Ohio court, whether that counted as a property or liberty interest.
Those are some pretty loaded terms.
They are. And the question is, are those interests protected by the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment?
And what did the Supreme Court decide?
Well, in a 6-3 decision, the majority said no. They said that Ferringer and Cambria's interest in representing Flint in Ohio did not count as a protected property or liberty interest.
Interesting. So how did they reach that conclusion?
Their logic was pretty straightforward. They said the Constitution doesn't just create property interests out of thin air. It protects interests that are already established by a state or federal law.
So if a state doesn't specifically create a right in its own laws, then the Constitution's due process protections don't necessarily kick in.
That's the gist of it. The majority really emphasized that, historically, states have had the primary power to decide who gets to practice law within their borders to license and regulate lawyers.
Like states' rights in action.
Exactly. And the court actually included a really key line in their opinion. The licensing and regulation of lawyers have been left exclusively to the states.
Pretty clear statement.
Right. So because Ohio didn't have any law specifically saying that out-of-state lawyers have a right to appear pro hac vice, the majority said that Ferringer and Cambria didn't have a protected interest that would trigger the 14th Amendment.
But wait, wasn't there a dissenting opinion in this case?
Oh, absolutely. Justice Stevens had a very different take on this whole thing.
What was his view?
Well, in his dissent, Justice Stevens argued that a lawyer's right to practice their profession is a protected liberty interest under the 14th Amendment. And he said that this protection shouldn't just vanish when a lawyer crosses state lines.
So he's saying it's about more than just what a particular state's law says. It's about a broader principle of fairness and the ability to practice your chosen profession.
Right. Justice Stevens thought it was inherently unfair to deny these lawyers the opportunity to represent their client without even giving them a chance to make their case.
It sounds like he's concerned about the potential for abuse if states have this unchecked power to exclude lawyers from other states.
Absolutely. He even used this phrase, arbitrary power is a remnant of a bygone era.
Strong words.
He felt like the majority's narrow focus on whether Ohio specifically created a right to pro hac vice admission, he felt like that missed the bigger picture.
So you've got this clash of perspectives.
Yeah.
Majority really focusing on state control and explicit rights, and the dissent emphasizing fairness and the practical realities of the legal profession.
Yeah, it's a great example of the different ways judges can interpret the Constitution and apply it to real-life situations.
Okay, so we've laid out the facts of the case and the Supreme Court's decision, but what about the impact? What happened after Lace v. Flint, and how does it affect how we think about these issues today?
Well, one interesting thing is that in the years after this case, a lot of states actually started creating more formal rules and procedures for pro hac vice admission.
So maybe they're taking Justice Stevens' concerns to heart.
Maybe so. Having clearer standards can definitely help to prevent the kind of arbitrary denials that we saw in this case.
And when we think about how much the practice of law has changed, how much work now crosses state lines, this all seems even more relevant.
Oh, yeah. Think about virtual hearings, lawyers advising clients in different states. The lines are definitely blurred.
So even though this case is from 1979, the issues it raises could easily come up in all sorts of legal battles today.
Totally. Imagine a big political case or a major civil rights lawsuit. A state might really want to prevent certain lawyers from outside the state from getting involved.
And Lace v. Flint seems to suggest that states have a lot of leeway in that area.
Which raises some pretty serious questions about ensuring access to justice and fair representation for everyone.
Absolutely. So as we wrap up our deep dive into Lace v. Flint, what are the big takeaways? What should our listeners, especially those who are studying law, really be thinking about?
There's a lot to ponder. First, should the Supreme Court have given more weight to Larry Flint's Sixth Amendment right to have the lawyer of his choice?
Right. The client's perspective in all of this is crucial.
Absolutely. Another thing to think about is how the precedent set by Lace v. Flint could be used today. What if a state tried to systematically block out-of-state lawyers from certain types of cases, like maybe cases that challenge state actions or policies? Could a state use this case to shield itself from accountability?
That's a pretty troubling thought.
And finally, does Justice Stevens' dissent, with its focus on fairness and the realities of modern legal practice, does that offer a better way to think about pro-hack vice admissions today?
It's a question worth considering.
So, yeah, Lease v. Flint might seem like a dusty old case, but it brings up questions that are just as relevant now as they were back then.
Right, so to bring it all back to the beginning, what's the big takeaway, the core tension that this case highlights?
I think it boils down to the balance between a state's legitimate interest in regulating its own legal system and the rights of individuals to access the legal representation they need, regardless of where their lawyer happens to be licensed.
And for anyone listening who might be practicing law across state lines, what's the practical lesson here?
Know the rules. Don't assume you have a right to appear pro-hack vice just because it seems fair or necessary. Every state is different, and you've got to do your homework and follow the procedures carefully.
So if you're an out-of-state lawyer, make sure you dot your I's and cross your T's when it comes to pro-hack vice applications.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, folks, that's our deep dive into Lease v. Flint. Thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Until next time.
See you then.